unfortunately, there's this bureaucracy in the government that, my personal experience, they do not want our soldiers, they do not want our citizens to have that kind of power over their personal information. So they're hostile to it. And so I'm just simply saying the war goes on. We're in an environment where we have, you know, call them deep state, call them whatever you want. But the fact is that they're hostile to liberty. They are hostile to the U.S. Constitution, Fourth Amendment, Second Amendment, the right to defend yourselves. I'm simply saying we all have a right to control our data.
Before I introduce our guest, I was hoping that I could ask a favor. And that favor is that you like, share, and subscribe to these interviews. It's because of people like you, people who take these interviews seriously and who share and subscribe and like and talk about them, that we're able to continue doing them. So I'm asking you this favor. Please subscribe, like, share, do whatever you can do to get the word out. Thank you. Today, I want to talk about cybersecurity. This is one of the most important issues facing the U.S. government today, and not just the government, but independent companies and American citizens, really. The CIA takes cybersecurity so seriously that it's actually established a brand new directorate. It was just four directorates from 1947 until very recently. Now there's a directorate that deals only with technological advancements in cybersecurity. DARPA is working on cybersecurity. NSA is working on cybersecurity. Even the military is working on cybersecurity. It's hard to protect us out there in cyber world, but the government is trying to do it while also trying to break into other people's cyber systems. It's a complicated situation, but we're going to talk about it today with Kevin O'Neill. He is the founder, chairman, and CEO of CYVA Research, and he's one of the country's leading experts on this issue. Kevin, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
Pleasure's mine. Thanks. I want to start off with some generalities. I'd like to get your thoughts about how you would assess, how you would grade big government and the information technology industry in general, big tech, in responsibility vis-a-vis cybersecurity. Are big government and big tech working together to protect us?
Well, I think independent empirical data is critical to answering that question. In this industry, we've had analysts following the statistics of data breaches, cybersecurity attacks for decades, okay? And it's a very well-documented phenomenon. And you can simply look at the paper every day, so another data breach of a hospital, another ransomware attack. Just on the high level, back in 2024, there were 5.5 billion, billion with the B, records compromised. Okay.
And that's up significantly from just a year earlier. Is that right?
Yes. Just amazingly. And so I'm simply saying that if you wanted me to grade the president and the secure border, I think he's done a great job. Okay. He just shut it down. Okay. And in fact, many Americans said, finally, we've now got a closed border. We have much better security of our border here. But I'd be honest with you, cybersecurity, I give them an F minus. It's bad. And I think everybody senses it's bad because who hasn't received a data breach notification?
You know, I wrote an op-ed a couple of years ago. I got a letter in the mail from the Office of Personnel Management saying that there had been a data breach. In the news, they reported that it was the Chinese government that had breached the OPM systems and that they had taken personal information. I wrote this op-ed because I said, I know what personal information they took. They took something called my SF-50, my standard form 50, which is the big overarching, all-encompassing document that everybody has to fill out when you first apply for a job in government. It had everything about my life in that document. And then you multiply that by how many millions of people over the years have applied for jobs in the federal government. This was a major data breach. It was a major violation of my privacy, and the privacy of millions of other Americans. And so what did the government do for us? It gave us 2 years of one of these services where they'll let you know if somebody's trying to steal your Social Security number. That was it. Otherwise, we're just kind of out of luck. Is there anything else that the government can and should be doing in a case like this?
Well, okay. As an engineer for 40 years, I'm protecting a bag of bits. All right. Right out of college, I'm working on a classified program called Data Vault. And so I'm simply saying, fast forward another 15 years, I'm head of a database design group for the worldwide Air Force, a worldwide war planning system. It's all top secret, all right? And so as an engineer, we build programs, and programs essentially are made up of what are called primitive data types, an integer, a letter, okay, such like that. And I'm simply arguing, as a software engineer, we've never created a new class of data objects that are self-protecting, okay? We've never created these data objects, or they're always under our control. They're simply primitive, weak, dumb data. So I started filing patents back in the 90s, creating a new class of objects. And this is a paradigm shift, guys, a complete new approach to cybersecurity, to reinvent or reimagine what a data object is. And I'm simply saying, as an engineer, I don't trust anyone. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. I want to control my data wherever it exists. And I know you, with your CIA background, you're indoctrinated to say, yes, you have your information, you have a secret message. You don't want anybody else to get a hold of that, because that might reveal the identity of an asset. Okay. And so it's life and death. So I'll get back to the basic point here. And I use analogies, John, to help people understand, who are not engineers, to understand what's going on here. For 85 years, our manufacturers of automobiles in the United States built cars in the millions, no safety belts. Okay. So you have this historical analogy that there are cars and there are accidents galore. Who hasn't been in an auto accident back in the 60s? Ralph Nader comes along, writes his book, Unsafe at Any Speed, The Design and Dangers of the American Automobile. And I'm simply saying, our data has no safety belts. And that is a design, that is a purposeful design in order to feed big tech and what? Making billions of dollars off of collecting our personal information and monetizing that through advertising schemes. So we live in a computer ecosystem that was built to surveil us and to monetize that information. I'll just stop with that and let you ask some questions. I'm simply saying, the infrastructure is there. Our data is weak. It's easy to collect and to monetize that. And that's the design of the system.
You are soft-spoken, and I'm hoping that our viewers understand the import of the words that just came out of your house. You're saying that our data protection is weak, our data is vulnerable, it's easy prey, and that this is by design by both big tech and the government.
So absolutely.
What's the purpose of this? If it puts all Americans in danger, why would government allow it to continue?
All right. We've had a war going on for years over who owns and controls our information.
Yes.
All right. And I think everybody can see that. They can feel it. They pick up a phone, they do a search on some golf clubs, and suddenly they get ads on their phones. They're on their browser looking at a vacation package. Suddenly they're inundated with advertising. We're all used to that. We're all aware of that. And I'm simply saying, the underlying infrastructure, like bridges and roads and et cetera, the internet has been rigged for slavery. All right. It's been rigged in such a way to promote tyranny. And the more information you have about an individual, such as your profile, your SF86 file, which was necessary to get your security clearance, it's filled with personal information that can be used against you and for you. But I'm simply saying, the very design of the information itself was built in order to make it easy for big tech and surveillance entities to collect that information. And so I'm very dangerous in this sense. If I give citizens the ability to control their information through what I call a personal information agent, and we filed these patents back in the 90s, all right? And I simply say to you, I now give you a tool or to a soft operator, you know, in Afghanistan someplace, and he has secret communications going on with an informant, you need to protect the identity of that informant and control the messages. So it's already been proven very valuable to operators, but unfortunately, there's this bureaucracy in the government that my personal experience, they do not want our soldiers, they do not want our citizens to have that kind of power over their personal information. So they're hostile to it. And so I'm just simply saying the war goes on. We're in an environment where we have, you know, call them deep state, call them whatever you want. But the fact is that they're hostile to liberty. They are hostile to the U.S. Constitution, Fourth Amendment, Second Amendment, the right to defend yourselves. I'm simply saying we all have a right to control our data, but they're adamantly against this. And I'm not saying everybody, okay? Because when I was asked to go back to SOCOM three times during COVID, there were soft operators that said, Kevin, this is great stuff. We need it. Let's move forward. But I hit this bureaucratic wall that was opposed to it. So I've documented the discrimination against inventors who own patents to order to enable warriors and citizens to control their data. And this right. war, I don't know, John.
I can see why government would not like that at all. I mean, that kind of helpful authority in the hands of an individual or a company represented by a small group of individuals, they wouldn't like that one bit, which actually leads me to the next question. The next question is, why is this all important to our liberty and our security? Can you explain that?
Well, I use a little formula. Namely, I have security plus privacy equals liberty. All right? It's a little equation to help people understand. And I'm simply saying security minus privacy equals anti-liberty state. All right? So when they take away your privacy or your right to control your information or the collection of your information, when you have no right of informational self-determination, you have now lost all liberty or any hope of it, all right? That is what the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, operates the largest surveillance infrastructure on the planet. I do not want the United States to be that, but we already have a de facto anti-liberty surveillance state, all right? It's run and operated by commercial companies who did the bidding of what I consider anti-liberty forces in our government during COVID to do what? To silence people. I mean, how many Americans didn't get to speak their minds on Twitter, you know, or some platform and were shut down? You know, there's a number of doctors, et cetera, who are trying to say, here, we need the data. Are these vaccines efficient? Are they effective? Where's the data? All right. So let me step back here. So privacy is critical to our liberty. That is the ability to control. I use the term informational self-determination. It's your ability to control your data. So I do want technologies to enable people to enforce their right to control their data. And perhaps more importantly is that I want to be able to build trust communities. You know, you have friends, you have families, you have people you communicate with. But there's so much technology out there now that I would call electronic warfare technology. You draw a little geofence around an area and the police go, hey, could we get every cell phone geolocation, every text message, everything in that? And that is happening now. All right. So it is being fought. There are state attorney generals that are now going after police, other agents and say, listen, you just violated the Fourth Amendment. Where is your warrant? Okay. But this is so widespread, and I'm simply saying Congress moves very slowly. The other aspect, John, is that Congress is very, and I don't want to say all of them are corrupt.
Right. Maybe not all of them. Right.
But most of them basically receive campaign funds from special interest groups. And so that's why we in the United States don't have strong data protection laws.
Yeah, because after all, corporations are people too, right?
Oh, absolutely. And so, again, another historical analogy to help people understand this. Maybe we're all aware, if you know anything about history, of slavery. Back to the Jews, you know, in Egypt for 400 years. Fast forward to the transatlantic slave trade that went on for almost 400 years here in the United States or the world, okay? But that industry generated incredible wealth for data slave traders and slave owners. I didn't know this until I read Bill O'Reilly's book, Confronting Evil. The two richest men back in 1838 or whatever were slave traders, all right? And they made billions, essentially, in turn current monetary. But I'm simply saying that the data slave trade is an article I wrote some 15 years ago. A lot of companies were not happy with me for characterizing them as data slave traders. Namely, they capture, they brand, they take our intellectual property. They declare that we're subhuman. Namely, we don't have any right to own or control our data. And they make billions and billions of dollars. So I'm simply saying on an ethical basis, and I'd like to talk about ethics here. What determines right and wrong? And that's a question for you, John. When you're a whistleblower, okay, you decided this was unethical torture. But I would ask you, what is the source of how you decide right and wrong?
Honestly, it's just in my gut. I like to think that we all have an innate sense of justice inside of us, and that is what should guide us in our daily lives.
Right. And so I would ask you again, very simply, is slavery evil?
Oh, yeah.
Is human trafficking evil?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So we all innately know that we have a conscience. I always say it was planted there by our creator. Okay. Yeah, and if you read the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that God has given us, our creator has given us these unalienable rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Guess what? Government cannot take that away.
That's right.
But they're trying.
You and I met a couple of weeks ago and had our first conversation. You said something that I think was very important too. You have, for decades now, you have successfully applied for a large number of patents. And this is exactly the opposite of what the government wants you to be doing. You've faced pushback from DOD, specifically from DARPA and governmental engineers. Tell us a little bit about that and why the Pentagon is such a roadblock for you, when the Pentagon should be welcoming you and the work that you do in order to make Americans safe.
Okay. I will not paint a broad brush on any human being on the planet without evidence, okay? I don't falsely accuse people of crimes, but if they do commit something and I document and I send it to my congressman, I expect them to uphold the law no matter who they are, right? You have the same expectation.
Absolutely.
Right. But we live in a world right now where we're obviously seeing the weaponization. Right? The weaponization of agents. If you confront the government with a crime, do they push back? Of course they do, John.
Hard.
Yes. All right. So I'm simply saying that there are plenty of people in government who I believe are sincere patriots. They love this country. They love the Constitution. They're willing to lay down their lives. All right. You know people like that. I know people like that. I was raised in the Marine Corps, all right? So I get invited 3 times to go back to SOCOM and talk about cyber warfare, all right? 3 times. People read my white papers on my augmented cyber warrior, my warrior-controlled identity and information asset management system, and I had individuals, soft operators, say, get this guy out here. This is critical to operations and operators. We need to talk to him. All right. And then I watched a bureaucracy prevent me from talking to this gentleman or even knowing him. All right. Second point, even though I do show up for a meeting in 2023 and we're looking at the future of cyber warfare, I mean, what the heck is Special Forces going to do in this whole new world of computers and networks and data? These men are trained to kill. All right. Kick down doors, be snipers, whatever. They're very, very effective, all right? But the fact is that they are not software engineers. They're not technologists. But they're simply saying, let's have a conference here. We'll spend 3 days here. I'm sitting with other security professionals in a group, about 10 people. We're in a team. 70 of us were invited. There was over like 200 and 300 people applied, but only 70 of us got chosen. I had a young man sit down next to me, in full view of my entire team here. And he says, I have military orders not to allow you to speak.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm going, Geisman, that's his name. You know, he's a lieutenant commander with Nav Air. Okay. I'm polite and professional. All right. I don't go into a rant crazy. Well, what the hell are you doing? Whatever. Right. I chat with a little while, but I said, sir, I'm going to continue to talk. All right. And the other people in the group, yeah, let O'Neill talk. All right. So I'm simply saying, we spent the next 3 days together. All right. We're in the same team. We'll go out to dinner together. And he explains to me, Kevin, I'm the program manager. All right. I decide what gets funded and what doesn't. And he states to me quite clearly, Kevin, I reject any SBIR proposal from a small business that owns patents.
Is it that they want to be the patent holders? Is that what this comes down to?
I do not know what's in the head of these individuals. I can only guess, right? You say, what was the motive behind you deciding not to allow funding for a patented innovation when the fact is that the United States Patent and Trademark Office is the only legitimate authority to decide if something is novel, all right? Is it useful? All right. Has it never been done before? Is it just not another variation of somebody's other technology? But these are the legal tests for getting a patent. My first patent took 3 years. The next one took 7 years. All right. But once they're approved, that is the only proof that I know of innovation. And why would a government agency, this is not an innovation. In fact, obviously, one of the statements rejections came back to me from the Navy was, obviously this is not an innovation because you own a patent.
The words don't even make any sense.
Yeah, you're squinting at me and I'm going, every time I share that with somebody, they do the same thing. That's backwards. Okay? It's illogical. All right. And I go, where do you get these ideas here? But let's go to DARPA most recently. I work on these proposals. The instructions are very long. And I look at this little section here regarding this reliance. It's a whole point is software, is it reliable? And I'm going, no. Is it resilient? No. All right. So they're trying to say, yes, we're DARPA. We want to look into this problem. We're serious about it. And I believe them. Okay. But why this bent not to approve proposals of proprietary technology that is owned by the individual or the corporation? And it was clearly in the statement to say, we will not look favorably on any submission that is proprietary. So I confronted while online, I'm invited to these gatherings and there's a program manager, he's speaking, and I'm simply writing in the little text here, what is your legal basis for rejecting or discriminating against patented innovations? I still have not gotten an answer.
Why do you think there is this hostility toward people like you when the innovations that you are coming up with are all meant to protect the safety of American, military people or American citizens who may not be savvy enough to protect themselves online? Why go after somebody like you?
Years ago, I work at a company called the Burton Group.
Okay.
I was an analyst. I wrote papers about privacy and security. And I talked about the different forces affecting privacy. All right. And I'm simply saying there is a kaleidoscope of different reasons for why people would not want other human beings to control their data. A primary reason is control. Namely, I, as a tyrant, do not want people to control their information. I want to control them, and I don't want them to know what I'm doing with their data. I don't want any transparency, okay? So that would be motivation one, and I'm looking at the Chinese Communist Party and going, yeah, they collect data all day long. They surveil people, and they say, oh, you know, has she been a good communist today? If not, she gets a social score, right? All right, and she's going to be persecuted. Same when I look at the military, our soft operators, we guard their identities. And you know why? Because they and their families are priority targets for our enemies. So what happens when we break into ISIS computers or Taliban or any of these groups? What do we find? We find detailed dossiers on our soldiers. They're all being hunted. All right. So I'm simply saying to SOCOM and all these other bureaucrats, why don't you fund these technologies in order to give these soldiers, these warriors, the ability to control their data and protect themselves in cyberspace? So again, to answer your question here, I say to my, are you hostile to having our soldiers have this capability? And I would say yes, but the reason I could only speculate. But I look at history, you know, anybody that has any background in history understands what Lenin and Marx were arguing for back in 1919 when Russia got taken over. But tenet number one was what? The abolishment of personal property. Mm-hmm. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, okay. Sure does.
You don't get to own factories. You don't get to own farms. If you don't go on to the collective, you get a bullet to the head. All right? That's it's right. Extremely violent when you look at Mao Zedong. All right? And the takeover of all farming. All right? And people starved. I'm talking millions. All right? But I'm simply saying that as a ideological thought, they are hostile to Americans creating and owning property because the collective, namely the government, wants to control all of that. And I'm simply saying, I'm a free market person. I believe in having competition, but I want that competition to follow rules.
Well, let's talk about that competition. You know, one of the big problems in the mainstream media is that just about all of the mainstream media is owned by a half a dozen conglomerates or billionaires. We see the same thing in national defense, where you know you've got Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and DynCorp and all these other giant multi-billion-dollar companies that essentially control everything having to do with defense. How do we change that? Is it possible to change that?
Okay. If you look at the defense industry, we had a former president when he's deciding, I'm not going to run again, Eisenhower, right? He warned everybody of the industrial complex, the military industrial complex. They have way too much power, right?
Mm-hmm.
You say, what was the driving force behind Vietnam?
Right. Okay.
What was 20 years in Afghanistan about? All right. And I want to say it was about money. All right.
Yep.
I want to say that these organizations, there's a revolving door between the federal government, the admirals, the generals, whatever, get hired into Northrop, hired into Lockheed, whatever. They pick up the phone, they call some of their former subordinates to say, could you help us with this contract? All right. And so it's a very self-serving system. Pete Hegseth has a major problem on his hands with the acquisition process, which is buried in red tape. It takes years, all right, to get stuff through the system. So that's one problem. The second problem is the self-serving nature of these organizations. And yes, just like antitrust back in, you know, you look at oil companies back in the 30s and the 40s and how ruthless they were, the rail barons, the bank barons, whatever like that. And you had a president say, I'm busting you guys up. And I think it's only through this, how should I say, judicial violence, you know, a court stepping in and a judge ordering, you got to break up AT&T. All right. I don't know any peaceful way to do that, but I'm simply saying, to answer your question here, I, as a small company, am competing against these giants who have an axe to grind or purpose to sell and operate surveillance capabilities on behalf of the government. And they are big and they're powerful. And I, you know, John, I can only do this. I can be a little revolutionary, like back in the Americans, our war against the British. We got mad enough and we said, enough of this nonsense. We can't have soldiers going into our houses, rifling through and looking at where we paid a tax on a piece of paper or something like that. But we decided enough was enough. We wrote the Declaration of Independence. We wrote a new constitution. And we said, we are going to go to war because it is necessary. It's a just war. All right. I'm not arguing for some sort of outright brawl in the streets, but I'm simply saying that, and I don't want to get too off topic here, we have billionaires who have incredible resources and monies. I watch them. I listen to them. Thiel, Musk, others. They say they want to produce or have safe AI. All right. I'm listening to this discussion here. But Jeffrey Hinton and a host of other AI scientists are going, time out, guys. We're headed down the wrong path here really fast here. And because of your greed and your lust for power, are we going to drive over the cliff here? Are we? All right. So I am, as an engineer, hope to disrupt. It's called disruptive innovation. You have an invention. You simply say, this will give the people the power to control their data. Can I get that out to the hands of people who love liberty? And they will be able to use that as a tool to, quote, curb the greed and the malice of large corporations that do not respect our privacy, do not respect our right to control that. And I can only see more and more people in the United States, once they're equipped with this, and that's why part of this video is here, is because I'm struggling to raise capital, because Silicon Valley over the years is just go, no, Kevin.
Yeah.
We're not interested in killing our revenues here.
Yes. Yes.
Right. All right. So I hopefully answered your question, but it's a big problem.
Yeah, it's a big problem. You published an article and posted it on X, formerly Twitter, recently, entitled Human Digital Liberty and Strategically Countering the Anti-Liberty Surveillance State. And you say essentially what you just said a moment ago, that techno-authoritarians and profit-driven surveillance capitalists don't want human beings to be able to own, protect, control, or monetize even their own digital identities and their personal information. Control of the personal information it's essential for them to drive profits and power, including political power. So what kind of actions can the average American take, A, to protect their personal data, and B, to try to keep these techno-authoritarians and other giants at bay?
Well, again, we were fighting the most powerful army in the world, namely the British, okay, back in the day. And by God's grace, we were able to overcome that tyranny, all right? And so, you know, as a believer in God, I do have hope, I have confidence. But I also understand the wickedness of men, okay? We see that every day. You've experienced that. And we have individuals like Brennan and others who have done terrible things. And we ask, where's the accountability for that? Where's a pardon for John? All right.
Yeah. That's what I'd like to know.
Right. Where's the pardon for this whistleblower? He did the right thing here and he got crucified. All right. So I'm simply saying that I want people to first be educated to know what the heck is going on here. Why is the internet rigged for slavery? Why is the internet rigged for tyranny? Would you please wake up to that and stand up? You know, you might write your congressman, etc., but I'm simply saying, I think I run into a lot of people that simply have lost hope. They feel it's just, there's just no way we're going to stand up against Alphabet or Facebook or any of these entities, etc. But I'm simply, as time has evolved here, we have state AGs who are now prosecuting Meta to simply say, you knew that your addictive social media apps and whatever would harm children.
Mm-hmm. It's like the Pinto all over again. Yeah. Ford knew that its Pinto with its gas tank in the rear was susceptible to exploding when it was in an accident and hit from the rear. But they figured that it would cost less to pay out wrongful deaths settlements than it would be to re-engineer the car and move the gas tank up to the center of the car. It's sick.
Well, I'm just simply saying it took 2 years for Congress to come out with the National Safety Act. I'm probably not getting it exactly right, but they did require manufacturers, GM, Ford, whatever, to make safety belt standard equipment. Now, I am not waiting for Congress to simply pass a law and says, listen, anybody that's processing personal information must provide the citizen the ability to control, to audit, to have the power, you know, the little lock button, hit lock, no further access. Now, I'm not saying that privacy is an absolute right. That's not true. All right. But I'm simply saying that you can carve out what our rights are in context here. If you're a criminal and you've been through the prosecution, you've been afforded due process, that criminal record is now public. You don't get to hide that, all right? But I'm simply saying that I'm walking down the street here and I'm a conversation with somebody. I don't want my geolocation being tracked. I don't want that being sucked up in some sort of surveillance ecosystem. And I'm very conscious of the fact that that's going on all the time. All right. And I want to have an end to that. But we're at a stage like an inflection point in a curve. And I'm asking a simple question here. When these companies are all in a race to earn $1 trillion for having the best AI tool, all right, and you have Jeffrey Hinton and others who simply say, guys, wake up. We have no clue what's going on inside of this neural network. The narrow AI that might be able to read the radiology and do it in seconds and figure out whether or not you got cancer or some other ill, that's great.
Yeah.
That's fantastic here. All right. But we go into these larger areas of autonomous weapons.
Right.
And we ask ourselves, where's the human in the loop to say, hey, that is not a legitimate target.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So back to your question here. I do need funding for my little invention. You know, I had bootstrapped this. I had a small group of angel investors a number of years ago, and we're out knocking on doors again of another group of venture capitalists. And I have sent proposals to Eric Schmidt. I have sent proposals to Peter Thiel. I have sent proposals to Elon Musk. So far, they haven't responded. Should I interpret that as being hostile to privacy innovation? You know, I hope they listen to this maybe.
You mentioned AI a second ago. I wanted to ask you a little bit about AI. You've come up with a couple of terms that I think deserve explanation. Human digital dignity, human digital liberty, and human digital integrity. You ask rhetorically, should our AI superintelligence and AGI efforts be guided by these same principles? Tell us about those principles and how they can be incorporated into this world of AI that is changing so quickly. I think it's really unlike anything we've ever seen before in technology.
God, you're good, John. You're an excellent interviewer. Okay. But, you know, I ask a very simple question. What is your ethical framework? What is your source of right and wrong when you build a technology? As an architect, we have been trained in architectural guiding principles, all right? And I wrote a paper many years ago about the ethics of privacy, and I got fired for... I did. I referenced the Bible, the Torah, okay? And Noah got drunk, and his son walked in and mocked him, or whatever. It was a violation of his privacy. But I was simply trying to argue and say, listen, our technologists need to have guiding principles on how they build technology. If you don't respect human dignity, if you don't even consider us to be human beings that are sacred, you know, as a Judeo-Christian mindset, I read the Bible and go, oh, we're created by God and every life is protected by him. And that's why murder is wrong. It's an offense to God, etc. But human digital dignity is simply making the argument we all have a human digital existence. It's no longer just this physical thing. It is now we exist. We have our being in a bunch of computers that are controlled by others who don't have our best interests in mind. Okay? And I'm simply saying you guys need to start respecting that we have a human digital existence. And number one, that dignity drives this whole notion of, are you pro-human or are you anti-human? Do you just want to round us all up and make us little automatons that do whatever you want us, another band of slaves in Egypt? Okay. And I'm simply saying the same callousness, if you watch the Ten Commandments and Yul Brynner,
right?
You know, in that old movie, et cetera, Charlton Heston,
let my people go.
Yeah, let my people go. And his response was, no, the slaves are mine. All right.
That's right.
Everything they own is mine. I don't recognize your God. Okay. And so I would ask, inventors, I always ask companies, etc., who is your God? Who do you worship? Is it the almighty dollar? I think that's pretty obvious. They love money and they love power, okay? And so human digital integrity is another ethic. Namely, I don't ever want to separate my data from my rules. I write the rules regarding who gets access to my information. This picture is for my wife only. All right. I don't want to getting sucked up in some surveillance infrastructure. I send a little text message to my daughter. I don't want that getting sucked up into some surveillance infrastructure. It's none of your business.
That's right.
All right.
That is
I'm right. Sorry, you're getting a little steamed here.
No. I think you've hit the nail right on the head. And before I know we're running late on time, before we go to our last question, I wanted to offer up a word from our sponsors. When okay. I was a kid, every Christmas morning, my parents would sneak a 1 ounce silver bar into my stocking. No explanation, no big speech. It was kind of fun. They'd put a lottery ticket in there and an orange and a candy bar. It was just a little bit of something real. At the time, I didn't really think much of it, but I held on to those silver bars, all of them. I've got about 20 or 22 of them now tucked away in a safe. When my kids were born, I decided to keep up the tradition, and every Christmas, I would drop a silver bar into their stockings too. And while I'm at it, I pick up a 10-ounce bar for myself. I have a bunch of them now. I've always liked the idea of giving them something that holds its value, something that they can actually touch and something they can keep. It might sound a little old-fashioned, but after working in the intelligence world, seeing how fast things can change, and usually not for the better, I've come to value the simple things that don't change. Paper wealth can vanish, promises can break, but an ounce of silver or gold is still an ounce, no matter what the headlines happen to say. That's why I was drawn to this new free report. It's called The Legacy Wealth Protection Blueprint, and it lays out how families are using gold IRAs to build real generational wealth, not just for the next market cycle, but for their kids and their grandkids and even beyond. If you're like me, You want to give your family more than just money. You want to give them stability and resilience, a fighting chance to stay free and independent, no matter what happens in Washington or on Wall Street. There's a report that lays it all out: strategies, pitfalls to avoid, and why more Americans are starting to move a portion of their savings into physical gold and silver. If that sounds like it's worth reading, check the link that we put in the show notes, the program notes. No charge, no pressure. You don't have to give up your email address. Just information I think more people need to see. You can also go to www.johnlovesgold.com. So one last question for you. I would consider you to be something of an activist. You're also an engineer. So you know the technological background of what you say. You're not just yelling about AI, you know, in these airy-fairy ways. For those of us who don't have the kind of technological background that you have, what can we do? Really, what can we do to try to protect our data? Is it just a matter of writing to your congressman? Or is there something tangible that we can do to protect ourselves?
Well, there are lots of security professionals and companies who sell VPNs and other technologies. So there's a lot of standard cyber tools. And so you go to YouTube, every night I see another person talking about their capabilities. Unplugged, you have very specialized phones that have been built to help guard your privacy and also protect you. But I'm arguing from a very fundamental, the atoms that make up data, okay? I'm simply saying the paradigm needs to change. We need to reinvent what information is. These other solutions, I think calling them Band-Aids is a little too harsh, all right? I would rather argue that they're the best that they can do given the science that they understand. But I would argue that we need to reinvent, we need to reimagine what data is at a very fundamental level and argue that let's do that, because once the data is now intelligent and it's been trained by me, the owner operator, then it can protect itself against a hostile AI or system. So I coined the term safe white box AI to contrast to black box, unsafe neural network AI. And John, there are many different types of AI algorithms. There are many different types of CPUs, NPUs, GPUs, etc. There are different approaches, just like there are different engines in a car. All right. And so I'm saying there is different technology. So I am trying to forward a specific type of AI used to give people power over their data wherever it exists, all right? And I'd like to equip everybody with that. Likewise, you can use existing technologies, you know, from good-hearted people who do want to offer you solutions with the current paradigm, you know, the dumb data paradigm. I hope that helps.
It does help. Kevin O'Neill, thank you so much for joining us. Kevin is the founder, chairman, and CEO of CYVA Research, doing really important work out there. And again, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Please do us the favor of liking, subscribing, sharing, talking about the show to your friends. Also, if you have a question, please put it in the chat. As you know, we collect the questions and we do Q&A sessions. So I'm John Kiriakou. Thanks again for joining us on Deep Focus. We'll see you next time.